Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about caches, and we're going to move from talking about sort of the operation of a cache to how caches can and cannot give you good performance for code you actually write. First, a logistical note. So most of you are working on the pipelining processor homework, and there's a second part of that homework that's after the lab this Wednesday, and that is due next week. And yes, I'm aware we also have an exam next week. So please keep that in mind. Obviously, a lot of the exam will be about pipelining. So we actually do want you to do the homework before the exam. Because we're likely to ask, like, how is forwarding supposed to work in this case? And hopefully having done the assignment will mean you know that better. In either case, you should not anticipate that there's going to be some sort of automatic postponement of the deadline for the assignment, like has happened in past semesters, that people seem to assume that that would happen, and it never has. So, just logistical note there. So, other than that, last time we were talking about write policies. So we had two options for writing. We had either write through, which is the simplest policy, where when a value is written to a cache, the cache just sends that write off to memory. And this requires no extra bookkeeping, but it means that every time we write, we might need to wait for memory. So that makes write slow, but in exchange, we don't need to do anything really special to deal with that. The other option was write back, where we get a write, we don't talk to memory, so it's fast. We aren't talking to this big, slow memory. We're only modifying our little cache. But that meant that later on, when we had to get rid of that value that was modified, we have to tell memory about it, because we haven't before. And if we don't tell memory about it, we're going to forget about the modification. And that means if you were writing a program and we didn't send it back to memory, you'd write a value a long time later, you read the value and it's different, even though you didn't do anything. You wouldn't expect that. So in order to implement this policy, we have this extra bit of metadata, which is called a dirty bit, which tells us this value I'm storing here is dirty, it's not the same as memory. I need to clean up memory when I'm done with it, even though I'm not actually writing to it when I'm done with it, I'm probably reading something else. And the other policy we have was allocate on write. This is the decision that if I'm writing a value and I don't already have a copy of it, do I want a copy of it? And having a copy of it seems like a good idea if you assume locality happens. But it can mean you have to do extra work you wouldn't have to do. So most notably, if you're writing a single byte in a large cache block, if you want to store that byte in your cache, you need to store the whole cache block. So that's an extra cost that you might be able to avoid by not actually allocating the cache block every time you write, instead just sending it through to memory if you don't already have that part of memory stored in your cache. Okay. So any questions about write back and write allocate? Okay. So we have this whole bunch of cache design decisions. Before I finish up writing. So one thing that caches do that's another design decision we won't go into detail about, but people are under the impression that because write back and write through, the way that works, that you imagine that the way it works is we write and we wait for memory to finish. That's what it sounds like, everything I described, is we write, when we need to talk to memory, we need to wait for memory to finish. This is not how real caches work. Real caches have something called a write buffer. So the way a write buffer works is that the cache has this little separate mini cache of things it's trying to write. And so even if memory takes a long time to write values, as long as there's not too many values being written, the cache just puts the value in the write buffer and moves on. And as long as it doesn't run out of space, the write is basically instantaneous. So this is useful especially for write back, because it means when we read a value and we need to write back the old value, we put it in the write buffer and we can finish the read. If we didn't have that, we need to finish the write, then do the read, because we wouldn't have any extra space to put the value. Okay. So any questions about this write buffer idea? Okay, so now let's go on to actually talking about what all our cache design choices mean for actual performance. Like, so our goal in caching is to make programs faster. And we want to decide what kinds of cache do we build. And we've sort of looked at these sort of qualitative ways of reasoning about what our cache design decisions do. But ultimately, we want to look at programs and say, are we going to make this program better? So one thing people do to evaluate this is they take some real programs and they measure how many cache misses you have with various cache designs. And this is done with a simulation. So they like build a processor simulator, something which looks at each instruction and keeps track of the state of all these variations on the caches. So it runs the program really, really, really slowly. But when they're done, they find out how well these caches perform for each of these designs. And from this, you can see, you know, what would be the program performance benefit of each of these cache designs. And you then look at the other aspects of, you know, building that cache, like how fast can you make it. And that's how processor designers decide, what kind of cache am I going to put in my processor? Am I going to make it 2 ways or 8 ways or 4 ways? They just look at these numbers and decide, when is it worthwhile to increase the associativity? When is it worthwhile to increase the cache size? Based on how does the MIPS rate change versus how much slower or fat am I making the cache by making that decision. And a general pattern we have is that we have diminishing returns. So one way you can see that here is that we get is that as we get to make the cache bigger, we eventually get to the point where we aren't really getting much benefit at all. We've essentially are hitting all the time that we can possibly hit. That it's not going to get any better by making the cache bigger. This is something known as an idea of a working set, that a program has a certain amount of data it cares about. And if you have more space than that, it's not actually useful. So in this case, when we get to 128 kilobytes, yes, we have less cache misses than before, but we aren't really gaining much more, because we basically have everything that matters in cache already. And we also have diminishing returns with associativity. So here, as we increase our associativity, we have this big jump when we go from direct map to two-way. But as we go from to eight-way or fully associative, we get this tiny, tiny benefit. We've gotten rid of most of the conflict misses by just stepping away from a direct map cache. And yes, there's more to do, but you know, there's these diminishing returns. So in practice, we're going to choose some design point which is not between eight-way and fully associative, but is earlier, because it's not worth the extra complexity to get 0.1% less misses. Yeah?
And that complexity comes from like the actual building of the hardware, right? And yeah. So is that seen in the expense or?
So the complexity I'm talking about is in the hardware. And so the most notable way that would come up is that if you have a fully associative cache, it's going to be a lot slower than an eight-way cache of the same size. And if you're only getting 0.10% of the time, is it faster, then you don't really care. And generally, when we reason about what it means to make a cache faster, we'll look at these statistics. So one thing is hit time. So some of our cache design decisions are going to make it faster when something is found in the cache. So if we have a smaller cache, it's going to be faster to look something up. So for example, the L1 cache typically needs to have a hit time of around 1 cycle. Otherwise, our memory accesses are slow, and we need to slow down every memory read, even the ones which have very, very good locality. And this limits the size we can have for an L1 cache. It also means we probably can't really have a fully associative L1 cache, because that might be slow. There's also the miss rate, which is what I showed you earlier. That's how often we find the value we want in the cache, which is based on what program we're running. So that's the statistic where we have to look at what program we're running. And in addition to the hit time and miss rate, we also need to worry about what happens when we do have a miss. How bad is it? So we have this thing called the miss penalty, which is the extra time to get a value if there's a miss. And typically, this is the time to access either the next level of cache or memory. So that's our miss penalty. And We also might sometimes talk about the missed time. The missed time is the time it takes to try to look for a value in the cache, then find out it's not there, and then pay the cost of looking elsewhere for the value. So it's usually hit time plus missed penalty. And a common statistic you'll see quoted is the average memory access time. So this is basically how fast do memory accesses appear to be for a particular program. And the idea is every time we access memory, we pay the hit time, we look in the cache, we get a value, and if it's a hit, we're done. If it's not a hit, we also have to pay this miss penalty. So based on the miss rate, that portion of the time, we pay the miss penalty, and that sum is the effective time that memory takes on average. So if we look at our memory stage, that's the average number of cycles it takes for every instruction which accesses memory. If this we're talking about the data cache. If we look at our fetch stage, that's the average amount of cycles it takes if we look at the instruction cache, the instruction memory. Okay. So any questions about sort of this calculation and why we might care about it? So, as I said, when we're looking at caches, a big factor here is what the miss rate is. And this means that there's never really a clear answer about whether one cache is better than the other, because you can always make it look bad. And there's this general strategy to prove that you can make every cache look bad, and that's to have this access pattern. First, access blocks to fill the cache. Then access any additional block you didn't access before. So it's going to have to be a miss because you never accessed it before. And because you filled the cache, it must replace something. Something in the cache has to go away, or has to have gone away in the past. And then so you replace something. Now access the thing that was just replaced. That's going to replace something again, probably. Access the thing that was just replaced again, and so on. So you can use this by looking at what the cache is doing exactly. You can construct this very pathological way of accessing memory that makes the cache look really, really bad. Because after we fill up the cache, we just have miss all the time. And we can just slightly change the design of the cache, and these won't be misses. Like, a slightly bigger cache is not going to have any of these replacements, most likely. Or slight changes to the cache design. So we can always make a cache look bad, so the question always needs to be about what are our programs actually doing. So it's not a question of one cache is definitely better than the other. So with that in mind, let's think about what cache optimizations typically do. And since you can make programs look bad, this one of these columns here depends on programs, and that's the miss rate. And what I've given here is what typically happens for normal programs, but you could construct a program which does something weird. But this is for typical programs with locality. For a typical program, if you increase the size of a cache, it's going to have a better miss rate, meaning a lower miss rate. But the hit time is going to be worse. For a typical program, if you increase the associativity of the cache, it's going to have a better miss rate and a worse hit time. A worse hit time because we have to look at more things to check tags, but a better miss rate because hopefully we have less conflict misses. And if we have, you know, a bigger block size, it varies what happens. But it's going to have a worse hit time because we need to get more stuff out of the cache in order to access the value. And our write allocate and write back policies, I say improve the miss rate. So that seems a little weird. But an important thing to remember is when we talk about misses, we talk about misses on reads and on writes. So effectively, for a write, if we don't do write allocate, we have misses on reads after writes, and also our writes are effectively misses if we don't have write back. It's another thing to think about. That, you know, ordinarily we'd use the cache on a read, on a write without write back we can't do that. So that's a case where we have a difference there. And there's one weird column here, which we kind of didn't talk about, which is adding a secondary cache. So all these other optimizations are about speeding up a particular cache, either making the cache itself faster or decreasing the miss rate. Adding a secondary cache is about the miss penalty. It's about what happens when we do have a miss. Can we make that better? And we can do that by, instead of talking to memory, talking to a secondary cache. If we design that second cache, the second level cache, right, we're going to decrease the miss penalty. And because we can add these secondary caches, designing your memory hierarchy is very non-straightforward. We have tons of options. So our goal is to get that average memory access time down that I showed you earlier. But since we can add these secondary caches, we have lots of ways to do that. We can adjust every single parameter by changing all these things about our caches. So people in practice who are designing memory hierarchies, they just do some simulation to figure out what the different design points should give them in performance and choose something which they think will do well. And that simulation is going to depend on what kind of programs they think they're going to need to run well. And this is why different processors come to different conclusions about what the right cache design is. So any questions about any of these changes? Okay, so we're talking about changes to caches. So let's try a little bit of exercise here. So let's say I have a cache with 64 byte blocks and 64 sets. So it says 64 times 64 bytes per way, and it has 8 ways per set. So it has 64 times 8 times 64 bytes. So I think it's 32. And question here is, which of these changes here will reduce the number of capacity misses? So remember, a capacity miss is a miss which would go away if we had a bigger cache. That's the reason we have the miss. So it's not a compulsory miss, meaning that it's not something where we're accessing the value for the first time. And it's not a conflict miss, meaning that it's not something where if we had more associativity, we might make it better. So which of these changes might improve the number of capacity misses? So anyone? Anyone want to volunteer an answer? Yeah.
I mean, A seems like
a
somewhat obvious choice.
So A would. So why would A?
Because you just physically have more stored things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any of the others? What?
I haven't gotten that one yet.
Okay. So A, one thing we think about is that if we have more space to store stuff, so in we made the cache bigger. So that should be increase the number of capacity misses. Yeah?
Is it true that if you have more ways, it's more likely that you'll hit the base address of a way that has the thing you're looking for in it?
So the question is, if we have more ways, will we have, does that mean we'll have?
If you have a 16 way cache instead of an 8 way cache, there's more individual items in each way.
Yeah.
Does that make it more likely?
Okay, so questions on that make it more likely to hit? Yes, it definitely does. All other things being equal, the question is, are we getting rid of capacity misses? So what do you have an opinion?
I don't know what capacity this is.
Okay, so one thing for thinking about this question is what do we do to the cache here on A? So in A, we now have 256 times 64 times 8 bytes in the cache, which is greater than what we started with. If we quadruple the number of sets without changing the number of bytes, block size, or the number of ways per set, we have 64 bytes in a block times 64 times 4 sets times 8 blocks in a set, which is bigger than what we started with. We have more space when we make these changes because of how I phrased this question. And for the last change, because of how I phrased this, because I told you we have 64 sets, now we have 64 sets, each of which has 16 blocks instead of 8. So we actually have more values in the cache. We made the cache bigger. And since all these changes make the cache bigger, they're all going to reduce the number of capacity misses. Yeah?
Did you go over the second one again?
So the second one, we increased the number of sets. So if you just take the top here, and if you imagined let's do a color you can read. Imagine I crossed this out and wrote 256 sets, that's a bigger cache. And so we made it bigger. Okay, so that's something, and that seems a little bit weird because we've maybe asked questions where it doesn't sound like this. Like, usually you think increasing the associativity just deals with conflict misses. And this is sort of a subtle issue about how I phrase the question. So here's a slightly different question where I just changed what I specified about the cache and told you what I left constant. So here, I specified the number of sets. And here, I'm specifying the total size of the cache and telling you that's remaining the same. So now, when we quadruple the number of ways per set to 32, I still have the same cache size because the question says we increased the number of ways per set without changing the cache size. So what do we change? What changes? So now. So if the cache size doesn't change, what must change? The number of sets. Because that's not one of the things I left constant. So that's a very subtle thing that confuses a lot of people when we're talking about changing cache parameters. So these are all related. If you change the number of sets without change the number of sets, something else has to change too, right? Because the cache size is based on that. So if you change the number of sets, either the cache size needs to change or something else needs to change. So you need to be careful to think about what values are changing, because it's not just going to be one. You can't just change the number of sets and expect everything else to remain the same, because some things are based on the number of sets. And that's true for every other parameter. Any questions about this kind of exercise? Okay. So let's move to a bit more realistic scenario. So I have some C code here. And assuming that array is the only thing that uses the data memory, and I only care about the data cache, I don't care about the instruction cache, how many cache misses are we going to have running this code with a 2 kilobyte direct map cache with 16 byte cache blocks? So try to figure this out and check with your neighbor. And if it helps, so a helpful assumption that you might make is that let's assume this is at address 0, just to make things simpler. And we only care about accesses to array. We assume everything else is in registers or doesn't use the data cache. Okay, anyone have an answer they'd like, that they are willing to share? Or an explanation or a question? So, the way I start thinking about this is, first of all, how often do we access the array? We access everything once. So we're not going to have any reuse of values. And the other part of the question is, how often do we access each cache block? So we're accessing each element of the array once, but a cache block contains multiple elements. In particular, if the array starts at address 0, our cache blocks are 4 elements of the array. So the first cache block is array 0 through 3. Then we have array elements 4 through 7. So those are our cache blocks. And what this code is going to do is, first we're going to load the cache block for elements 0 through 3. And we're going to access each of those elements. Then we're going to load the cache block through elements 4 through 7 and access each of those, and so on. So we're going to access each cache block exactly once. So the question is, how many cache blocks do we have to load? And that's going to be 4 kilobytes, the size of our array. Divided by 16 bytes, the size of a cache block. Does that make sense? And so that's how many misses we're going to have, because each of those first accesses is going to be our misses. And then the next time we access the other three parts of the cache block, it's going to be a hit. Any questions about my reasoning here? Yeah. Yes. Sorry, I should have specified. And cache starts empty. I should have specified that because you don't know. That's an important piece of information. Yes. Does it matter that I'm incrementing I? So it matters that I'm going through different parts of the array. If I accessed 0 and 1 repeatedly, there's obviously, I'd only have one miss. The variable I itself does need to be stored somewhere. We're telling you to assume that it's kept in a register, so it doesn't matter. If it wasn't kept in a register, but was on the stack, for example, we would might have more cache misses because of that. Any other questions? So here's a different version of this code. So I just rearrange things. I compute the sum of the even number, even indices, and then the sum of the odd indices. So how many data cache misses do I have now? Yeah. Twice as many. So why twice as many? Yes, so we're accessing this every block the same number of times, but we need to load every block twice. And the problem here is when I equals 0 here, we access the block containing array 0 through 3. And when I equals 0 here, we do the same thing. But in between, we've accessed more than 2 kilobytes worth of stuff. And I equals 1 through 24, access much more than 2 kilobytes worth of stuff. So we're going to run out of room in our cache. In particular, when we access the backup part of the last 512 elements of the array, that's going to evict the first 512. Because it happens that the set that array 0 maps to is the same as array 512. We'll go over that next. But the basic idea is we're accessing things the same number of times, but we we load the block once, access it again once, then we access a whole bunch of other stuff, which is going to make us run out of room in our cache, then we access that block again. So even though we're doing the exact same calculation, this code is going to have more cache misses. So we have, as it said, twice as many. Okay, how about the second question here? Would a set associative cache do any better? So people are shaking their head. So no, the problem was we just ran out of space. We have so much stuff we're accessing in the between that a set associative cache wouldn't help us. And that's because we can only access whole blocks. It's even though, if you think about this first loop, each of these for loops here, they're only accessing 2 kilobytes worth of stuff. But the problem is to load those 2 kilobytes of stuff into the cache, we actually need to load 4 kilobytes because we can only load the whole blocks. So this is an example of why when you're writing code, you might need to care about what the cache is doing. Because this program will run slower than the first program I showed you. And this is something where you have control over the performance. Yes. And if you want to think about exactly what happens here, and this will help us in a bit, is that the way things are going to map to this cache is that we have 128 sets, and set 0 contains address 0 through 15. That's array 0 through 3 is array 3. Set 1 contains address 16 through 31, and so on, all the way to the last set, and then we wrap around. So this means that, you know, in our first pass through the array, we load the block at 0, block at 16, so on. And then when we get to array 512, it maps to set 0 again. And so that means that when we load array 512 or array 513, we evict the block containing array 0. So that's how we know that happens. This is obvious in this case because we had 2 kilobytes worth of blocks. Of course, we couldn't fit them. But sometimes we might need to reason about exactly what happens if we aren't accessing a big contiguous set of blocks. So how about this code? So here, I have these giant structs with 128 integers, and I'm just selecting one from each and adding them up. And I hope that's 4K. Is that not actually 4K? Can I not add multiply? Yeah. That would be an example of me doing the math correctly. 8 kilobyte array. Anyone want to try to explain what will happen here? So we're not accessing anything close to, so we're not accessing 2 kilobytes worth of cache blocks here, clearly, because there's only 32 values in total. So the maximum we could have is 32 cache blocks. How many cache blocks are there actually involved here? Blocks of memory. So our cache blocks, again, hold 4 integers. So probably these two values are probably both in the same cache block. Because they're next to each other in memory and our cache blocks are bigger than an integer. It's not guaranteed, but almost, it's very likely that that's true. Yeah.
How do you know that they're
next to each other in the three? Like, is that just what structs?
Oh, okay. So that's a good question. So I've written the struct this way. Why would it have to be like that in memory? Can't the C compiler do something else? And it's reasonable to think that, and in some languages that the C the compiler would arrange structs however it likes. In C, you are actually guaranteed that the struct members are in order in memory, in the order you specify. This is just something that C provides to you as a promise. So how many cache misses should we have here? So our ideal case would be we load items 0.a value, and later on we load items 0.b value, and hopefully it's a cache hit. So what would stop that from happening? Yeah. So if there was a conflict, so how would we know if there was a conflict? So the way we'd know is we'd look at whether the address is mapped to the same cache set. So if we have too many things that map to the same cache set, we're going to have a problem. And an observation you can make here is that this is the same offset in memory as array 0 was before, and this is the same as array 1 was before. That makes sense? Or not 0, but array 127 and array 126 and 127. That makes sense? So we can look at our old array case, the old array we had, and figure out what happened there. And if we go to how that mapped cache values, we're going to have a problem if we're accessing these things which are related by these things that are kind of close to powers of 2. That's just how it works out. So it makes sense because they're part by, we store 2 kilobytes worth of stuff and then we wrap around to the beginning of the cache again. So if two things are exactly 2 kilobytes apart, they're going to map to the same cache set in our direct map cache here. And that is in fact a thing which happens here. It happens that items 0 and items 4 are going to be 2 kilobytes apart. Apart, which means that they go to the same cache set. So we have this problem here where even though we're accessing very little memory, we're going to have a lot, we're going to access item 0.a value, then we're going to access items 4.a value, and that's going to be mapped to the same cache set because the addresses are related. They're separated by 2 kilobytes, which means that they have the same bottom bits, they have the same set index bits. So that's going to be a miss, so we're going to have conflicts here because we happen to have nice powers of 2. And this is something we could have avoided by writing our code differently. We could have designed this in a way where things didn't happen to be related by powers of 2 and we would have a lot less cache misses. People look confused, so I'm hoping there are questions I can clarify. Yeah.
Could you explain how the item being separated by 2 kilobytes?
So if we look at how things map to cache sets, so here, Set 0 can store addresses 0 through 15 of memory, or 0 to 15 plus 2k. And we get plus 2k because if we go through all the sets, we get to 2k, and we wrap around. Remember when we first showed it. Another way of thinking about it is that if we two things are separated by 2k in addresses, they have the same bottom bits of the address, which means the set index bits and the block offset bits of those two addresses are the same, so they go to the same part of the cache. Yeah?
But how are four 128-byte objects 2 kilobytes apart? Aren't they like 512?
It's possible I did math wrong. It's 128 times 4 is 512 bytes. That's the size of the struct, assuming I didn't mess up. And four of the, so the struct is 512 bytes. Does that make sense? Did I?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
And we have four of them, that's 2K. And so that's what separates different things we can store in the same cache set. Any other questions? Things I can clarify to make this easier? We'll go through some other examples of the same kind of issue, which hopefully will give opportunity to ask questions. Okay, so we're going to go through this general concept of looking at what the cache performance of our code is. And I've given you some examples of how that when you're writing C code, there are things you can do which will hurt or help your cache performance. And the question is going to be how we, you know, what are strategies we can use to consistently get good performance from our caches when we're writing code. So I'm going to go through examples that involve matrices, because this is one of the most common types of problems in practice where people need to care about how caches work. And when I'm dealing with matrices, I'm going to use this kind of funny notation. So I could use 2D arrays, but first of all, it's not clear how 2D arrays would be laid out in memory. And secondly, it's actually hard in C to allocate a 2D array dynamically. So I'm going to use this notation where I access ij, row I, index j, by using this sort of pointer to a flat array. Any questions on what I'm doing here? So it's an n by n matrix. I take the first index, the row number, multiply times n, add the column number. That is how I get the element I'm accessing. Any questions on this notation? Since I will use it a ton. Okay. So I'm going to go through an example with this problem of matrix squaring. So matrix squaring, it's some linear algebra. I don't actually care if you know the linear algebra. This is the formula. So we take, for every I and j, we do this. And here's the most straightforward code to do it. So I'm just adding to BL, row I, column j, multiplying two things from A. From A, row I, column k, and row k, column j. And accumulating that in each B. So this makes sense. Okay, so this is one way of writing this in C. And here's another. So it's the exact same thing, I just changed the order of the loops. I'm doing all the same calculations, I'm doing the same B plus equal stuff, just in a different order. So which one of these is gonna be better performing? And you should think about which one of these is better for the cache. Anyone have an opinion or a reason why it's we can't tell? Yeah?
Does the fact that like once we have beats try to store like these kind of stuff in like a row major order help at all with like how the cache would access things?
So is the fact we're storing rows together helping? So it might help if we access rows together, right? If we only access columns together, it won't. But it might help because one of the things caches take advantage of is spatial locality. So one thing you might think about in comparing these is which has better spatial locality? Why the first one? So it's accessing all the rows of B in order, is what you're saying? So that seems good? Yeah, you seem to have a caveat. You don't like that answer anymore?
No, I think I might have just read it wrong. Okay.
So we're accessing all the rows of B in order here, so that seems like an advantage for the first one. That we're accessing a row of B together, and the row of B is next to each other in memory, so that's better spatial locality. We aren't gonna have conflict misses. We're going to access different parts of the same block together, so it seems better. Anyone have any conflicting opinions, any reasons why that might not actually work out for us? Yeah?
The second access of A is going like A is the row and K is changing a lot.
Okay, yeah, so we have this access here where K changes and jumps all the way around. We have really bad spatial locality. And in the second example here, in the second loop, that's much better. So something you notice here is that by changing the loop order, we've made some kinds of our locality better, and sometimes our locality is worse. So it's not actually obvious at all which of these will do better, but it's clear that they have different kinds of locality. They have locality in different places. So the thing you want to do is measure it. So I measured this, the two orders. So I measured how many instructions it took. They have the exact same number of instructions because we just changed the loop order. And I measured how many cycles they took. And that is very different between the two. And you may notice these like peaks. Those are not measurement errors. Those are real. But you see that in general, we're usually the alternate order, the order where K is the outermost loop, is about twice as fast. And that's just because the locality changes which happened, the ones that got better in that second version were more important than the ones which got worse. Does that make sense? So the only I wouldn't have known that this would happen if I didn't run it, but I did. Okay. And another way we might view this, and I'm going to show this some other time. So here I'm just showing you comparing the number of cycles it took. When we're dealing with varying sizes, that's not very useful for comparing performance directly. Like we want to know like efficiency. So another view we might use is the number of cycles per instruction, which is basically sort of related to how often are we stalling for the cache, right? We're going to take more cycles to run each instruction if we're stalling more often, meaning our cache is slower. And we can also use a sort of operation-centric thing. This scale doesn't start at zero, by the way, of how many cycles does it take per operation, in this case, per addition or multiplication. And that's a useful metric because that lets us compare things where we might be doing the calculation completely differently. But you can see that even though we're doing the exact same calculations, because my cache efficiency is better, I'm getting better efficiency on this problem, especially for larger sizes. And larger sizes are cases where the cache matters more. When we have really small sizes, it doesn't actually work out that way because we have more cache hits, just because it's less data and more other overhead. And so one way of looking at this systematically is that we traded off spatial locality in the Bijs and AKJs, and temporal locality in AIK is what that's what we got. Whereas before we had some spatial locality in AIK and temporal locality in Bij, and that just happened to be better. So you probably, if you reason very carefully, could have figured out by listing out the locality like this that this happened. And this would happen here. But there's no, it's not really a reliable thing because you don't really know without knowing more about how the machine works, whether, you know, writing is going to matter more than reading or anything like that. But the like practical lesson here is that you should try to change the loop order to see if you can get more locality. So it's a simple thing with a big performance impact. But it's kind of annoying that we previously had with our different two orders here, when we were doing k last, we had pretty good spatial locality in AIK, and we don't anymore. In the better loop order, the one where we do k first, we're changing k very infrequently, so we don't actually take much advantage of loading AIK and the things next to it in its cache block. We don't have good spatial locality there anymore. And where before we had good temporal locality in BIJ, because we were doing K last, K was the innermost loop, with the new faster order, we access an element of BIJ once, and we don't access it again until we go through the whole thing. So you have a lot less temporal locality in BIJ, and that seems kind of like a shame. That is there some compromise which does better? And we're going to talk about getting that compromise which does better. Okay. So, but does it make sense like why we have this big difference and what things we think about when analyzing the difference? Yes, no. Okay. So that was just, we're just changing our locality. And so one thing we saw here that I mentioned is that we have these spikes here. And you know, I told you those weren't like measurement errors. So anyone have an idea what those spikes come from? Why do we have them? This is, as I'm changing the size of the matrix, for certain values, I get these little slower performance. Any idea why that could be happening? Of two. So you notice that these spikes are at powers of two. So what's bad about powers of two?
Thrashing, like in the previous.
So like in the example we showed, I told you earlier, when we advance by a power of two, that's going to be, might be the size of a cache. So two things that are two parts of the matrix might map to the same cache set. And that's going to be particularly true when they're a power of two elements apart, meaning that the set index bits won't change. So that partially explained. So let's look in a bit more detail at the miss rate. So this is a, this is not a chart of cycles, this is a chart of the L1 misses, which I have a way of measuring. This is something you can do on a modern processor for the two orders. And you can see that the spikiness looks a lot worse here. So let's take a very detailed look. So one thing you'll notice is that we have a very low miss rate for these small sizes. And you may wonder, like, what's special about this number right here where that starts increasing? And that's exactly the spot space where the matrix fits in the L1 cache. Like, you can read out the cache size from this benchmark, and that's typical. And then we have a typical miss rate here, and we have these exceptions. So, and some of these exceptions are powers of two. So this is, I believe, 128. Some of them are not. But the ones which are not are very related to powers of two. So for example, we have a spike at 114. It turns out if you multiply 114 times 9, it's very close to the 10. And this is going to matter when we look at what cache sets things map to. So if A of k times 114 plus j is this address, then as we advance k, we get a similar bit pattern when we get k plus 9, because 9 times 114 is almost a power of 2. And if you remember what we do when we look up a value in the cache, we're going to, some of these, the parts of this address are the block offset, so we only use them after we've actually found something in the cache. Another part is the set index, which determines what cache set we go to. And here are, for my desktop where I ran this, the set index bits highlighted. So you can see, when we advance k by 9, we have the same set. And that happens a lot, and that means we have all these extra conflict misses. So this kind of problem explains why we were concerned about conflict misses. So we have conflict misses here, even though we didn't do anything weird. We're just accessing a matrix in the stored in the natural way, and we happen to get lots of conflicts. We even avoided using a power of 2, but we end up with something close enough to a power of 2 that we get in trouble. So any questions about these conflict misses? So I'm not going to give you much solutions to these conflict misses except to say that they happen. We'll do things which will happen to help with conflict misses, but the systematically dealing with them we probably won't get to. Yeah?
Why does mapping the same set guarantee a conflict miss?
So it doesn't guarantee a conflict miss. Because, so in a direct map cache, it means that you can't access, you can only store one thing in each set, right? So that's going to give a conflict miss. In an associative cache, the question is how many things map to that set? So my cache is actually set associative. So I could store two of these values, but if I have like 12 of them, I might get in trouble. And that's going to be what happens because we have like a matrix with, you know, 100 things in it. And every ninth goes to the same set, we're going to run out of things, run out of space in that set, even though that set has more than one slot. Okay. Okay, so let's think about how we can improve our loop order example. First, let's think about how we can reason more carefully about which loop order is best. And we're going to do this not with the goal of choosing the best loop order, because really the best way of doing that is just to run each of them, but to have a better idea than just changing loop orders for improving our cache performance. We're going to try to do better than any loop order will do. But to start out, let's think of, you know, our good loop order here and think of what happens. So to think about this, let's take an easy case to think about, which is that we're going to assume n is really, really big. And this makes things easy because we can assume that any time we go through n things, we've accessed so much we can't cache anything. So we don't need to worry about thinking about conflict misses right now because everything's going to be capacity misses. We're going to run out of space because n is so big we can't fit a single row in cache. And that means that we can think about this inner loop here, that we're going to go through every j, and there's going to be enough j's that we only have to worry about what happens in iterations of the innermost loop, because after that loop, anything that we we accessed everything in a row, we're not going to have the beginning of the row cached anymore. So it's only a question of what values do we access repeatedly, what things do we have spatial locality within the innermost loop. And we can say here, we access bij once in the innermost loop. We have some good spatial locality there, but other than that, you know, we access it once. So every time, so we have one access to bij, we need to get that into the cache, and we that's all we did. We use it once. When we access this a I times n plus k, we actually use that value n times. So that is the value we're getting the most benefit of our cache from. So that we're storing that aik. When we access this akj, we fetch the value, use it once, then we're done. So an observation you can make here, even though this is the best performing loop order I showed you, even though it's better than the naive one, basically, as far as temporal locality goes, we're only really getting benefit from aik here, when n is really big. Everything else, the cache isn't really doing much. It's helping because we have spatial locality, so some things go to the same block, so we have less misses than we could, but we aren't getting real benefit out of the cache. Basically, we're using our 64 kilobyte cache to store one element of A, and that's about it. Does not seem like a great use of our cache. So we want to try to figure out how to keep more values in cache. And the key way we're going to do that is we're going to try to choose what values go in the cache. We're going to try to think explicitly about doing that. Previously, we sort of had this, it's an accident what values end up in cache. We want to think about choosing what values end up in cache and taking advantage of that. We can't actually put a value in cache explicitly, but we can say, I'm going to access these values together, and that means they're going to stay in cache, hopefully. So that's going to be how we're going to reason about it. And so we're going to have this optimization where we're going to choose to keep more values around. But first, and I'm going to try to fix some inefficiencies I have. So right now, one way of looking at this is that with our loop order, we're accessing one element of aik repeatedly and this row of a and b. That's what we're doing right now. And that's what the innermost loop is. If n is really big, you know, the red things are what's in cache, and this aik is the only thing which we actually reuse in the cache. So what we can think about doing here, saying is happening here, is that we're basically saying if we explicitly wrote down what gets loaded in the cache, you know, this isn't quite what happens, but it's basically what's happening, is we're planning to load an element of A and then load each element separately. So we're doing about what, we're loading one thing for each time we add or multiply from memory to the cache because of how this code is organized. So I'm going to show you a trick where I can figure out how to load more values. And so what I'd like to do, the simplest thing I'd like to do is, I'm loading one element of A here. Maybe I could load more than one and take advantage of that. So I'm going to do this transformation to load that. So first, I'm going to do something which won't change this code at all. Okay. So I'm just going to split up the loop over k. Does that make sense? So I've written the loop over k with two loops, but it still goes from 0 to n. Now, I'm going to move that loop into the innermost part. So I didn't change what this code does, I just reordered the operations. But as far as what's going to happen to the cache, this is actually much different. So what I'm basically saying here is that I would like to load two elements around AIK. And that's what I'm going to use. Sorry, I'm going to load two elements right here. Because I use these same two elements of AIK in that loop instead of just one. So previously I was using one value. This was one value. Now there's two values I'm using repeatedly. So I'm getting more use out of my cache. All the other accesses are the same badness, but now I'm getting more use out of my cache. Because I'm, instead of looking at one part of AIK, I'm looking at AIK and AIK plus one, and I'm using them in repeated succession. So a way to look at this is if I expand that, what I'm doing here, if I expand this innermost loop, I have these two values which I'm accessing repeatedly. So loaded into cache. That makes sense? Here. So now instead of caching effectively one value, if n is big, I'm caching two values. And by doing that, I also made the other parts of this loop better. Because now I'm accessing the same element of B twice. And I'm accessing, and I have a bit better, no, I don't have any better locality there. Same element of B twice. Okay, so I also got better locality in the BIJs, which we were only using once before. So it makes sense why I might think I have better locality here. So I've improved the situation from only having this one value from A be accessed repeatedly to now I have two values from A I'm accessing every time through this innermost loop. And the value from B I access twice instead of just once. So this should give me better cache performance. And if I measure cache misses, it in fact performs better. I get half as many cache misses. So does that, this make sense, this transformation I did here? So, any questions on, so why this idea works? So what I've done here, so I've improved my locality by, in a way which I couldn't get by just changing the loop order. I decided I'm going to take this block of 2k values at once because that's what I want to keep in the cache. I decided I'm not just going to keep one value in AIK in the cache, I'm going to keep two. And I changed the loop order to let me do that. And I can apply this process to more values. So I can split up the loop over the i's and say, I'm going to keep the values not just two values AIK, I'm going to keep a 2x2 block of values around AIK. I'm doing the same procedure of splitting up the loop in order to say, I don't want to load just you know, so I'm, this is means that here I'm loading AIK and AIK plus one and AI plus one K and AIK plus one. So in this, these inner loops here, I'm using that whole block of data rather than just like before I was just using AIK. And I'm also accessing not just, I'm accessing BIJ repeat more times than I was before. I'm accessing BIJ plus one multiple times, so I have more locality in pretty much everything than I did before. And the reason I could do this is because I have a little less locality in A. I'm not accessing the same thing over and over again. I'm accessing the same four things or so over and over again. So I have a little worse locality, but not in a way which matters for the cache performance. For, as far as the cache is concerned, I have this whole block of data I can keep around. So another way of looking at what's happening is now I'm loading this block of A here, this block, and I'm processing these strips of the other values we access. So in my innermost loop, I'm keeping this whole block in my cache, and I'm making use of these other values with that whole block instead of just with one value. And that's how I'm getting a lot better, gonna get hopefully better performance. And the key idea here is that what I've chosen is that I've observed previously I was just keeping this one element from A in the cache and using it over and over again. I decided I want to keep a whole bunch of things in A. And I reordered my operations so I could do that. So I kept all the calculations on that part of A together. Does this make sense? So we can generalize this concept here. Which is what we'll talk about next time, along with going over exactly what the locality looks like here, into saying that we're going to take a block of I, J, and K, and we're basically going to process a block of each of the things we're accessing that fits in the cache. So the idea is we'll take the biggest set of values that fit in the cache, and we'll process them all together. So we'll have all the calculations in this part here should stay in the cache. And then we'll take the next block, and all those should stay in the cache. And this way, we'll get full use of our cache, not like we were before, where we basically had one value that we were using the cache for. Here, the idea is that we choose the sizes of these loops, so the entire thing uses the cache, and we use those values as many times as possible while they're in the cache. We use the whole cache, not just one block of the cache, to store that one value we're accessing. We store all these values, you know, several kilobytes of values, and do all our work on it. That's what I have for today. Thank you.